Come to the final part of a lecture that I began last Lord's Day entitled Pastoral Concerns for Homeschool Families. A few weeks ago, we began a short series of studies on the subject of believers and their children, and we have come in that series to the very important subject of the education of children. Last Lord's Day, I began to address the volatile issue of homeschooling. Sometimes it can be looked upon as the third rail that pastors are not supposed to touch in churches, but I believe we're mature enough not to consider it that way at all. I began last Lord's Day with two simple assertions that I endeavored to address both biblically and confessionally, since we, along with our sister churches, are fully subscribing confessional churches. And the two assertions I made last Lord's Day were these: that the practice of mandating that parents must homeschool their children violates our confession of faith and the biblical doctrine of liberty of conscience. We must not be a people who mandate homeschooling. And secondly, that mandating that homeschooling is the only method of education cannot be sustained biblically. And so those were the two things that I endeavored to cover last Lord's Day. This morning, I want to finish up our consideration of homeschooling, and I trust that what I have to say will be helpful to those of you who are considering the practice or are now involved therein. I have four main points to cover today, and this will be a little longer than last Lord's Day, but I do want to leave time at the end for questions as well. But I want you to consider in the first place the goal of all Christian education. What is the goal of all Christian education? Whether it be home school education or it be private Christian school education, what is the goal of all Christian education? What should be the goal of all Christian education? Well, I believe it's summed up for us in many verses of the Bible, but the one I want to focus on in this hour is just this simple statement in Luke 2:52, where it says, "And Jesus kept increasing in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men." And here are four areas of human development, and what Christian parent worthy of the name doesn't desire their children to develop in all these areas? There is physical development, and so we focus on adequate nutrition and exercise and rest and doctor and dentist visits. And there's intellectual and practical development bound up in the idea of increasing in wisdom. For biblically, the concept of wisdom includes but is not limited to the intellectual. Wisdom includes the intellectual, but it's not limited to the intellectual. Wisdom biblically is skill in living. And don't we desire that for our children to grow up to be wise? There's spiritual development in the phrase increasing in favor with God. And any education that fails to teach that we are creatures of God and answerable to God is deficient education. And there's social development seen in the phrase increasing in favor with man. And there are a whole number of characteristics that must be acquired if a child is to develop in favor with man. Qualities like an ability to cooperate and work well with others are absolutely essential to increase in favor with man. Qualities like politeness and promptness and a good work ethic and an ability to make and keep friends are all included under social development, aren't they? I love it when some of you say to your sons, when I greet your little boys, and you say to them, "Now shake Pastor Dykstra's hand and look him in the eye when you're doing it." I love that. Shake Pastor Dykstra's hand and look him in the eye when you're doing it. What you're doing is starting the training of a boy to act like a man. And so there's all these qualities that are to be in place when we're thinking of the education of our children. And Luke 2:52 is a good text. And this ought to be viewed as a goal in all Christian education. We want our children to increase in wisdom. We want our children to increase in stature and in favor with God and men. So there's all of these kinds of development in this text. Listen to this description of life in the towns of New England in the 18th century of Jonathan Edwards's day, contrasted to life in isolated homesteads in that day. And you have to bear in mind that there were the towns of New England, and then there were people living completely on their own out in the wilderness. And listen to the contrast of the children growing up in the communities contrasted to the children growing up in the homesteads. And this is from Ian Murray's biography of Jonathan Edwards. The close grouping of the Northampton community was rather the result of a principle carried over from English village life and followed throughout New England. Dependent upon the soil for their livelihood as they were, there were higher considerations which influenced them. For social friendships, for the education of their children in a common school, and above all for united public worship, a people had to live together. Timothy Dwight visited other parts of the United States before the end of the 18th century and noted the different outlook of farmers where their homes were not close together. He found such scattered settlers to be better acquainted with oxen and horses than with human society, and easily directed by foul weather or the ill state of the roads from hearing such itinerant preachers as might visit their district. A New Englander passing through such settlements is irresistibly struck with a wide difference between their inhabitants and those of his own country. The scene is changed at once. That intelligence and sociality, that softness and refinement which prevail among even the plain people of New England disappear. Intelligence bounded by the farm, conversation confined to the price of a horse or the sale of a load of wheat, ignorance at 50 years of age of what is familiarly known by every New England schoolboy, all spread over a great proportion of the inhabitants. New England presents a direct contrast to this picture. Almost the whole country is covered with villages, and every village has its church and its suit of schools. Nearly every child, even of beggars, in considerable numbers, can read, write, and keep accounts. Every child is carried to the church from the cradle, nor leaves the church but for the grave. All the people are neighbors, social beings, converse, feel, sympathize, mingle minds, cherish sentiments, and are subjects of at least a degree of refinement. In almost every village are found literary men and social libraries. A great number of men also addict themselves to reading and acquire extensive information. Of all these advantages, the mode of settlement has been one, and it is believed a powerful cause. And so, what great statements about what the superiority of community life, of village life, compared to that which they found on the homesteads, and particularly in the education of the children. The goal, then, of a Christian education should be development in all of these areas: physical development, social development, intellectual development, in favor with God and man. Here's a blueprint for parents and a test for children from Luke 2:52. A godly parent will be concerned about all these areas where growth and development is called for. We desire growth in stature. We feed them well. We require physical activity, getting on their case if they're developing into lazy couch potatoes. We desire growth socially, and so if we are wise, we force them out of their comfort zones and require interaction with others. We desire their spiritual growth, and so we bring them to the law and the gospel. And since faith comes from hearing and hearing by the word of Christ, we make sure that they're present in the church where the law and the gospel are declared, and we teach them at home and we pray for them. We desire them to grow intellectually and practically, and so we make sure that they're adequately trained educationally and practically. We manifest before them a lifelong desire to learn and teach them to likewise be learners throughout their life, to have an inquisitive mind always. And all of that is seen in Luke 2:52. And that should be the goal of all Christian education. whether it's a private Christian education, it's a homeschool Christian education, or it's some combination of the two, which is becoming much more popular in our day. Consider in the second place your motives for homeschooling. And I want to address what they should not be and then what they should be very quickly. Motives for homeschooling. Consider what your motives should not be. Firstly, you should not be involved in homeschooling to prove your capability. That's just pride. Secondly, you should not be involved in homeschooling to thumb your nose at the state. That's just rank individualism and arrogance. Thirdly, you should not be involved in homeschooling to conform to a group's expectation that you do so. That's just conformity to a group. Those are all wrong reasons to get involved in homeschooling. Consider what your motive should be. You should homeschool only if and when you are convinced that it is a means of fulfilling the mandate of Ephesians 6:4 and that you can do it. You should only homeschool when you believe that you can fulfill the mandate of Ephesians 6:4 to bring your children up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord and that you can do it. Consider in the third place your ability to homeschool. The notion that any and every parent has the ability to adequately educate their children for life in the 21st century is, in my opinion, ridiculous. The notion that any and every parent has the ability to adequately educate their children for life in the 21st century is ridiculous. The recent teacher strike in Chicago resulted in turning the national spotlight on those schools, and conservative commentators were quick to point out the educational weaknesses of that system contrasted with the salaries of the teachers. We were all appalled to see how poorly the students in Chicago do when it comes to reading and math, and contrasted with the Chicago public school teachers having the higher salaries of any public school teachers in America. And we all said, are you kidding me? You're demanding, what was it, 16% increase in salary when your performance levels are so appalling? And most of us said, no, this is ridiculous. And so we're all, as conservative Christians, very, very adept at pointing out the failures of the public educational system. But for a long time now, the homeschool movement has been unwilling to address the subject of failures in its system, or even wanting to address the subject of failure, the failure in many homeschooling environments. The homeschool movement has many a record of success. We all love to hear reports of our students excelling in colleges and universities and receiving praise from their professors. What the movement as a whole seems unwilling to talk about are its failures. And I can speak from experience on this. As one who has experience as both a teacher and as a principal of a Christian school to which homeschool students would at times matriculate. And many, many a time, the homeschool kids that would matriculate to the Christian school were just fine. Sometimes they were ahead, and they came in with in a seamless transition to the Christian school. Our youngest had that experience. My wife homeschooled our youngest two for a few years, and then we had the opportunity to have them go to the Christian school, which all of my four girls graduated from, and I was very proud of my wife and the job she did in the early years because my two girls, Josie and Katie, had no problems at all in making the transition. They were right up with the class. They were doing the work that they should have been doing at that level, and it was a good Christian school with a very high academic standard. But that isn't always the case. I remember experiences as a principal of a Christian high school where kids matriculated from homeschool into the high school and they were nowhere near ready, either academically or socially, for matriculation to the school. So we must not be a people who are so quick to point out the failures of the public school system, but refuse to even consider the subject of failures in homeschooling. That's just dishonest. And we must not do that. And so you need, that is those of you who are thinking about it, though there are some of you with young children who aren't yet being educated formally, you need to assess your gifts and ability. The scriptures teach us that teaching is a gift that not all possess. And when Paul says that an elder candidate must be apt to teach, the assumption is that not all men are apt to teach. And an eldership must not contain men deficient in the gift of teaching. You can't teach what you don't know. You can't teach what you don't understand. At the most, all that experience will be an experience of shared learning. But shared learning is not teaching. And so when you're assessing your ability to homeschool, this is very basic. Teaching is not shared learning. Teaching only takes place when one with understanding can impart that understanding to others that are willing to learn. You may try to teach what you don't understand, but the best that will be accomplished is a shared learning experience and, at worst, a botched education. So assess your gifts and ability. And then I would say, secondly, test the results of your teaching. Some of you use standardized tests, and this is good. We used to do that. We used to use the Iowa tests. Some of you, I understand, use the Stanford tests. If your children are to go on to higher education, they will have to face standardized tests to get into college. They'll have to face SATs. We used to use a series of books entitled, and this is a great series, I don't know if we still have them, if they're packed away in the closet or not, or if we gave them away, but a series of books with titles like this: What Every Third Grader Needs to Know, What Every Fourth Grader Needs to Know, What Every Fifth Grader Needs to Know, What Every Sixth Grader Needs to Know. And those are simple books to say, okay, am I keeping up with what my child needs to know? Those are very, very helpful, because they test us. And if you're not able to equal the education received in a good private or public school, you should rethink homeschooling. You should at least be able to equal the education that is received in a good public or private school, or you should rethink the whole matter of homeschooling and maybe consider some other options. Doug Wilson, years ago, and I don't quote him on every subject, but years ago he wrote a very helpful little book entitled Recovering the Lost Tools of Learning. And in that book he wrote this: as a rule, the average parent who attempts to keep pace with the education that goes on in a good school will have increasing difficulty as the years go by. Many parents can do an outstanding job the first several years, but it's one thing to teach your 5-year-old how to read and quite another to teach Latin to an 11-year-old. For starters, you have to know Latin to teach it. And at a Christian school, if one teacher knows Latin, then 20 students can learn it. But in order for 20 students in homeschools to learn Latin, 20 teachers have to learn it. This is an inefficient division of labor, which leads to burnout. If homeschoolers attempt to solve this problem by having all the children among the various families learn from just one teacher, then we have the rudiments of a new alternative Christian school. The same problem applies to any field of specialized knowledge not common to all parents: music, foreign languages, advanced science, advanced math, etc. The reason homeschooling works so well at the early years is that the parents are teaching literacy and they're all literate. This is not true of subjects later in the curriculum. And I say amen to that. Burnout is a very serious problem. We don't have time to turn to the passages, but some of the classic passages are Exodus 18, 13 through 27, and Numbers 11, 10 through 27. It was Moses' father-in-law who said to him, "The thing that you are doing is not good. You will soon wear out both yourself and those who hear you." And his father-in-law recognized that he was approaching burnout. And sometimes moms get burned out. And when they do, it's the responsibility of the husband to recognize the symptoms of the burnout and to make decisions unitedly to deal with it. Because the education of children is too important to botch. It is just too important to botch up. Burnout affects others around you, and attempting too much, according to Exodus 18:17, is not good. A third thing that I would say if you're assessing your ability is just determine if you have the personal discipline required to do a good job. And if you are not a disciplined individual, you should not be homeschooling. For your ill discipline will be replicated in your children. And Luke 6:40 is a very important text about education. It says, every disciple who has been fully trained will be like his teacher. It doesn't say he ought to be, it says he will be. Luke 6:40. And so if you come into homeschooling as a person with little in the way of personal discipline, whether it's the personal discipline of getting up on time, it's the personal discipline of beginning a job on time, it's the personal discipline of just doing what you don't feel like doing just because it's required to do it. All of those things are involved in being disciplined individuals, aren't they? But if you're a person who doesn't have individual disciplines, you will be tempted to say at times to your kids, "Well, let's just not have school today." And then that leads, over the course of months and years, to a botched job. Because one of the things that you can always count on in a good school is that the teachers are going to have the lessons for that day, whether they feel like it or not. When I was a principal, I used to require of the teachers that were under me to show me their lesson plans a week in advance. I wanted at least to be able to see their lesson plans. What's your lesson plans in math for next week? What's your lesson plans in English for next week? What's your lesson plans in chemistry for next week? At least show me your lesson plans so that I could see them and know that the kids were going to be taught those lesson plans that day, whether you felt like it or not. And one of the real enemies of a good homeschool education is an ill-disciplined individual involved in homeschooling. And this is all part and parcel of assessing your ability to do a good job. The scriptures call us to discipline yourself for the purpose of godliness. And there is no such thing as developing in godliness without the development of discipline. And also in this whole matter of testing and testing your kids by standardized tests just to test whether or not they're getting an adequate education, I do want to say that in our greater Houston area, there is no good reason not to take advantage of the many aids offered to homeschoolers, especially for those of you who live south of the Woodlands. There's so much that's available to aid homeschoolers. We had my wife's cousin and her husband up for dinner on Friday, and you can look this website up on your own. Look up a website for Schola, S-C-H-O-L-A. And that's Latin for a meeting place for teachers and students. You'll find a whole web page for Schola. And it'll it adds, as it were, to, it's for homeschoolers. It's for homeschooling parents to bring their kids to a particular PCA church that opens their church building up for classes, and from 6th to 12th grade, the kids can come in for classes. And for those of you in the greater Houston area and south, you could take advantage of things like that. There's not just that. There's all kinds of things in our area. There's the classical conversation, whole development around the nation. In fact, that's the one that this lady that I've just recommended is involved in Virginia. The whole classical conversation consortium, as it were. So in our area, there's all kinds of things that are open. And so I would just encourage you to determine if you have the personal disciplines required to do a good job, to test the results of your teaching, to assess your gifts and ability to teach. In the last place this morning, I would call upon you to avoid becoming an undiscerning and uncritical follower of the movement of homeschooling. Avoid becoming an uncritical and undiscerning follower of the movement of homeschooling. There is such a thing as a movement mentality that can carry people along. And I would suggest that if you have been involved in homeschooling for any length of time and have been exposed to books and seminars and conventions and to popular figures in the movement of homeschooling, and if you have not detected a number of wacky perspectives and ideas, then you are not a very discerning person. We used to go to homeschool conventions in Pennsylvania every year when we lived back in New Jersey, and it was a real eye-opener for me. Many of the seminars were good, but some of the people teaching seminars were nuts. They were just nuts. And the homeschool movement as a whole really attracts some real nuts. And if you haven't picked up on some of the nuts that are in the homeschooling movement, then you're not a very discerning individual. And the discernment is the ability to distinguish between things that differ. Here are some things I noticed early on. As part of some of the nutty aspects of the homeschooling movement. One of them that really got to me, being a lover and a teacher of history, is teaching propaganda and not history. The homeschooling movement is full of people who teach propaganda rather than teaching history. One author observed this, that church history is taught as though Pentecost happened in 1776. And as though Franklin, Jefferson, and Washington were numbered among the apostles, with Paine perhaps playing the role of Judas. But a Christian view of history and a Christianized version of history are two entirely different things. Isn't that a great statement? A Christian view of history and a Christianized version of history are two entirely different things. I remember one of the books that I reviewed years ago for whether we were going to use with our kids or not was a book entitled The Light and the Glory. In fact, I reviewed this to see whether we would use it as a textbook in our Christian school, and I decided, thumbs down on this one. The Light and the Glory by Peter Marshall and by David Manuel. This is, I'm quoting now from The Light and the Glory. On and on they went, but the debate was deadlocked and growing more bitter. Part of the New York delegation went home in disgust, and others were preparing to leave, but God once again had mercy on the affairs of America, and this time he used the 81-year-old Benjamin Franklin. The elder statesman rose to his feet. At the beginning of the war, he said, calmly we prayed for divine protection. Our prayers were answered. I've lived a long time. The longer I live, the more I see that God governs in the affairs of men. A sparrow cannot fall without his notice. Can an empire rise without his aid? And Franklin wiped his glasses and continued talking. The book of Psalms assures us that unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. We can build our house in America only with his help. I therefore move that from now on we begin each session in prayer, asking for assistance and blessing from heaven. This speech marked a turning point And nearly all of the delegates were Christians of one kind or another. Franklin's words forced them to set their priorities right. The delegates moved forward with the business of crafting a new constitution. They signed it on September 17, 1787. This all sounds so wonderful. Sounds like Franklin was a Christian, doesn't it? From what they say. Problem is that facts are stubborn things. I could quote to you right now, if I wanted to, a letter of Ben Franklin to a younger man, advising the younger man on the benefit of having an older woman as a mistress. A postmenopausal woman as a mistress, and an older woman who, with experience, who can keep her mouth shut. I could quote that, but I won't. But the notion that Benjamin Franklin was a Christian is nonsense. It's utter nonsense. So a Christianized version of history and a Christian view of history are two entirely different things. And so make sure that when you're teaching history, you do not teach propaganda. You teach history. Recently, World Magazine has had a couple of stories, at least, about the David Barton controversy, describing the reaction to his book, The Jefferson Lies, and promoted by Glenn Beck. You can read the articles in World, August 25th, 2012, and September 8th, 2012. I'm not going to take any sides on the story, on the controversy, but I'm saying you should read it. And you should know both sides of the story. With Christian historians who say Barton doesn't get it right. Barton's giving you propaganda. And so all I'm saying is you need to pay attention. And when it comes to history, you must not teach propaganda, you must teach history. Whether you like the history or not, is unimportant. And then there's a second problem that's often involved in homeschooling, not just teaching a Christianized version of history, teaching propaganda rather than real history, but the danger of having an overly optimistic view of your children. Wilson wrote this: "There seems to be a prejudice among some homeschoolers against forced learning. And the prejudice appears to be based on an overly optimistic view of the child's innate love of learning. For example, one advocate of homeschools writes, 'Deep within your children already naturally, organically love to learn. Let them intrinsically inside themselves feel the joy and excitement because therein lay the true, natural, most highly motivating reward and the most highly effective learning. Once you and they are able to rekindle that joy they were born with, motivation and learning for them will never cease.'" And Wilson says, I'm afraid there's more than a little sentimentalism here, with the nature and power of sin being overlooked. Many children need to be disciplined in an intellectual way early. If they are not, then the opportunity is lost. A mental laziness is already habitual. J.C. Ryle wrote the following. Well, let me get, I think this is more of Wilson's comments. He says, it is, "Despite our biblical understanding of man's sinful nature, we still sometimes believe that sin is merely a learned behavior. When little Johnny comes up with some foul word at the dinner table, two things come immediately to mind. First, it's assumed that he doesn't know what it means and wouldn't ever want to say it if he did. And secondly, he must have picked it up from that Billy Jones down the street or at school, somewhere else, anywhere else. It never occurs to us that Billy's parents may be complaining about our kid." So Christians must distinguish the natural from the spiritual and stop making surface judgments. For example, children are naturally curious. This curiosity is God's given, but it is not the same thing as a love of learning. If a teacher is careful, the curiosity may develop into such a love, but if the teaching is poor, a love for learning will never develop. And then Ryle wrote this. our original sinfulness. And I found this so amazing. This is from Expository Thoughts on Mark, and he's addressing public schools, a public school education and a private education. And this was written back in the late 1800s. Listen to what Ryle wrote. It's almost as if he's writing it for today. Our original sinfulness and natural inclination to evil are seldom sufficiently considered. The wickedness of men is often attributed to bad examples, bad company, peculiar temptations, or the snares of the devil. It seems forgotten that every man carries within him a fountain of wickedness. We need no bad company to teach us, and no devil to tempt us in order to run into sin. We have within us the beginning of every sin under heaven. We ought to remember this in the training and education of children. In all our management, we must never forget that the seeds of all mischief and wickedness are in their hearts. It is not enough to keep boys and girls at home and shut out every outward temptation. They carry within them a heart ready for any sin, and until that heart is changed, they're not safe, whatever we do. When children do wrong, it's a common practice to lay all the blame on bad companions, but it's mere ignorance, blindness, and foolishness to do so. Bad companions are a great evil, no doubt, and an evil to be avoided as much as possible, but no bad companion teaches a girl or a boy half as much sin as their own hearts will suggest to them, unless they are renewed by the Spirit. The beginning of all wickedness is within. If parents were half as diligent in praying for their children's conversion as they are in keeping them from bad company, their children would turn out far better than they do. The common arguments against public school education appear to me based on forgetfulness of our Lord's teaching about the heart. Unquestionably, there are many evils in public schools. However carefully conducted, it must needs be so. We must expect it. But it is no less true that there are great dangers in private education, and dangers in their kind quite as formidable as any which beset a boy at public school. Of course, no universal rule can be laid down. Regard must be to individual character and temperament. But to suppose, as some seem to do, that boys educated at public schools must turn out ill and boys educated at home must turn out well is surely not wise. It is forgetting our Lord's doctrine that the heart is the principal source of evil. Without a change of heart, a boy may be kept at home and yet learn all manner of sin. One of the other great dangers in the homeschool movement, and we've watched this develop over the decades, and we saw it early on, is making the jump from homeschool to home church. This is one of the huge problems with the homeschool movement. This is common and wrong, and it's a natural jump from one to the other. When you make the jump from saying that parents can do an adequate job in educating their children to asserting that no one else can or should educate them, then you can anticipate that the people who could never find a school that was good enough will soon become those that can never find a church that's good enough. And the advocates of home church deny the biblical doctrine of the church and wrongly assert that the husband and father is also a competent pastor and minister of the word. This is radical individualism of the worst kind. Denying the progressive revelation of the scriptures and taking us back to patriarchal times in the teaching of the scriptures. And often we've noticed that the proponents of home church are also, and I'm talking about the guys who write the books. Jeff Barth is an author that comes to mind that was writing when we were involved. Often the proponents of home church are also noteworthy for having bizarre views of husbandly authority and bizarre views of wifely submission. And if you don't pick these things up in the movement of homeschooling, then you're just not very discerning. the movement as a whole can attract a lot of bizarre views. So having lived for a while now, having seen as a father and as a pastor this movement develop, I don't want you to be just an uncritical follower. I want you to see the dangers and avoid them. And if you're doing a good job right now in the education of your children, just keep it up and do a good job. But test yourself to see if you are. And if you're not, then take advantage of many of the opportunities that are in our area that you can use to make sure that your children are raised according to the standard of Luke 2 and verse 52. And